Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The first month of the South Dakota legislative session is highlighting new challenges, particularly around pandemic-related issues and some familiar battles. Think transgender discrimination. For our weekly SDPB Journalist Roundtable, we're going to explore some of that familiar territory. Joining us today, we have Jackie Hendry. She's host of South Dakota Focus on SDPB-TV, and she's with us from the Kirby Family Studio inside SDPB Sioux Falls Studio. Hey, Jackie, welcome.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Seth Tupper, SDPB's Business and Economic Development Reporter, and he is joining us from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital Studio in SDPB's Black Hills Studio in Rapid City. Hey, Seth.
Hi, Lori. Good to be here.
And Lee Strubinger, SDPB's Politics and Public Policy Reporter, and he is joining us from Pierre. Welcome, Lee.
Hey, Lori. Good to be here.
I'm going to start with Jackie Hendry today. I enjoyed watching your first South Dakota Focus on Thursday night last, where you tackled civics, education, and a whole lot more, really. And I want to start with anything that you kind of, you know, gleaned from that civics conversation, as we haven't seen the full result of, you know, legislation regarding this. I'm going to just remind listeners of what Governor Kristi Noem said in her State of the State address, which was that she had tasked her administration with creating instructional materials and classroom resources on America's founding, our nation's history, and the state's history. She said, we must also do a better job educating teachers on these three subjects. Through all of this, our common mission and key objective needs to be explaining why the United States of America is the most special nation in the history of the world. Jackie, some of your guests' thoughts on this civics education topic.
Right. Well, being that, you know, just before this position, I was education reporter, one of my favorite things is to talk to teachers. And I was excited to get to do that for this first show. The interesting thing in kind of the leadoff story of last week, we were able to talk with the president of the Sioux Falls Education Association. They had put out a statement shortly after the governor's, both the State of the State address and also their statement was in a bit of a response to her editorial that she published through the Federalist. And in that editorial, she uses the word indoctrination, implying that teachers across the nation are indoctrinating students either against the United States or somehow misleading students about the history of the United States. The Sioux Falls Education Association did not take kindly to those remarks. But he also explained that these social studies guidelines that we're talking about, these state standards related to those are reviewed on a 7-year cycle. So and that cycle is up this spring. But another part of the conversation I want to highlight is our live guest was Patrick Ganey from the Spearfish School District, a social studies teacher, chair of their social studies department in that school district. And I asked him what he would say to claims of indoctrination, and he said, you know what, no country is perfect, but we can still do great things. And here's what he had to say about what it means to teach history in the classroom.
You know, we don't teach history so kids learn to love their country or hate their country. We teach history so kids can understand their country, so that when they get to be adults and taxpayers and parents, they can make the kind of decisions, they have the kind of information necessary to make these important decisions. So history can't be a history class can't be a gripe session or a pep rally. It needs to be honest with students. They're smart enough to know the difference. They're smart enough to figure this out.
So, and I should point out, Mr. Ganey also said, if someone's waiting for him to complain about the governor wanting to throw $900,000 at civics education in the state, they're going to be waiting an awfully long time. So it's a matter of, well, we're going to have to wait and see what this curriculum includes. But for the most part, he seems kind of, in a way, happy that it's getting a certain amount of attention.
Yeah, and a reminder, it was due for the attention that it would normally get, and it was up for rotation
exactly.
for that kind of examination to begin with. This week you're working on another topic which a lot of people are talking about, and that is the proposed merger via executive order from Governor Noem of the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Environment and Natural Resources in the state. Tell me a little bit about why that is such a big deal right now for so many in South Dakota.
Right. The main concern I seem to be hearing from folks on social media and kind of throughout conversations is that this idea that these two separate departments serve as a sort of check and balance to each other, and what happens when they merge into one and then the goals of each are opposed to each other. Coming up this week, we're going to have two live guests to kind of support a roundtable discussion of what this means. Scott Vanderwall, who's the president of the South Dakota Farm Bureau. That organization supports the merger, talks about how this will streamline the experience for producers. They call it practical common sense to combine the expertise of these two departments and have that staff have a better understanding for their members' day-to-day operations. So that idea of streamlining. Our second desk, Doug Somke, who is president of the South Dakota Farmers Union, that group, the largest group in the state, opposes the merger. And they bring up that same point, that these two departments are supposed to serve as a check and balance system for each other. And interesting, I just happened to notice this morning the statement from the South Dakota Farmers Union. They point out that only two other states in the nation have merged their agriculture and natural resources department. That's Alaska, whose ag economy is about a $40 million industry, and Rhode Island with a $170 million industry. And compare that to South Dakota's $10 billion agriculture industry. They're not the same. So the Farmers Union have their own concerns about this.
I want to bring Seth Tupper into the conversation because, Seth, you're working on a Why Is That segment, and with a little history of these two departments, tell us a little bit about what you've been finding out as you move forward on this project.
Yeah, I wanted to look into the history of the Department of Environment and Natural Resources because one of the things Governor Noem is proposing in the merger is to rename it the Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources to remove the word environment from the name. And just to hit the high points of what I've found, DENR actually has its roots in 1973 when Democratic Governor Dick Knipe created the Department of Environmental Protection. And that arose out of the environmental movements of the 1960s and 70s. It was a response to those movements. Happened around the time that President Nixon created the EPA on a national level. But that creation was only temporary. In 1979, Governor Janklow came along and merged the Department of Environmental Protection with another department, and it became the Department of Water and Natural Resources. And then along came Governor George S. Mikkelsen, and in the early 1990s, he actually renamed the department what we know it as today, the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. And that grew out of a major environmental protection bill that he announced in his 1989 State of the State Address.
I want that development to occur without damaging our environment, without destroying our Black Hills, without poisoning our drinking water, without dumping garbage from New Jersey in our backyard. Ladies and gentlemen of this legislature, 100 years from today, I want whatever governor is the governor of our state to stand here and shout back through time to you and me and say thank you for how you preserved our precious prairie state.
I should add that the garbage comment was a proposal to open a major landfill near Edgemont and receive garbage from out of state that ended up quite controversial and never actually did happen.
Interesting. Oh, I love these segments a lot. And you're also following something, Seth, which is fireworks at Mount Rushmore on the 4th of July because there's a new administration, and of course President Trump brought those fireworks back in 2020 and visited Mount Rushmore with Governor Noem. Tell us a little bit about that conversation and how it's progressing for 2021 fireworks.
People might remember it was July 3rd, this past July 3rd, when President Trump attended the fireworks at Mount Rushmore, and that was the first time in 11 years that they had had fireworks there because of concerns about the fireworks causing wildfires and some of the chemicals in the fireworks getting into the groundwater out there and debris from the fireworks littering the grounds of the National Memorial there at Mount Rushmore. But they brought them back, and of course now we've had a change in administration. As you noted, one of the biggest fans of the fireworks was President Trump. He's gone, as are most of the top people at the Interior Department, which oversees the National Park Service in Mount Rushmore. And so our intrepid reporter, Lee Strubinger, last week asked Governor Noem at her press conference if she wants to have the fireworks again.
Yes, absolutely. I'd love to have President Biden at Mount Rushmore on July 3rd with the fireworks as well. I'm hopeful we'll be able to keep them. I think we proved last year that we can have an event that focuses on our independence as a nation and that also can be celebrated safely and protect our forests, and people can attend and also protect our water supply and soil.
All right, Seth, so a lot needs to happen between now and then if they are to go forward. Where are we at in that process?
Well, it seems unlikely, perhaps, that the Interior Department will allow fireworks this year, or at least that the opponents to the fireworks will have a lot better reception in the higher ranks of the Interior Department, because President Biden's Interior Secretary is Deb Haaland, who was a Democratic congresswoman from New Mexico. She's the first Native American Interior Secretary. And last July, she actually gave an interview to MSNBC where she spoke out against the fireworks at Mount Rushmore. Mm. She expressed concerns about the fire risk, about the lack of masks and social distancing, about putting firefighters at risk just to do fireworks, and about the lack of or inadequate consultation with Native Americans who formerly held the Black Hills as part of their treaty rights. So with her at the top post in Interior, certainly seems like it's going to be a different story this year. I put in a question to the Interior Department, haven't heard back to hear if they've made an actual decision on that yet.
Yeah, interesting. Lee Strubinger, there's some familiar topics today, whether it's civics or fireworks. And you've been following some kind of familiar territory as well. Tell us about some of the bills and conversations you've got your eyes on right now.
Yeah, certainly. Well, you know, this morning, Governor Noem announced the introduction of her legislation that she mentioned during the State of the State address, which was a bill to ban Down syndrome abortions. I don't know if it's up on the LRC website yet, but I did get
it's
a PDF copy.
It's not yet.
Copy.
I just checked. Yeah.
Yeah, I did get a PDF copy of it, and it basically says that you know, no person may perform or attempt to perform an abortion with the knowledge that the pregnant woman is seeking an abortion because the fetus has been diagnosed with Down syndrome. And so it targets the abortion providers and not necessarily the woman who would seek an abortion. And it also would allow anyone to bring a civil suit to obtain liquidated damages in the amount of $10,000. And so I reached out to an OBGYN from Rapid City after this, after she made this announcement during the State of the State, and they basically said that, and Planned Parenthood also says this as well, that this just doesn't really happen in South Dakota, because in South Dakota, abortions aren't really provided after 13 weeks and 6 days at the one facility in the state, which is the Planned Parenthood in Sioux Falls, and most of the testing for you know, Down syndrome occurs at the 16 to 20 week you know, time frame during a woman's pregnancy. And so I asked the governor about that last week in the Thursday press conferences, and here's what she had to say in terms of what this bill would actually do.
This bill would prevent doctors from knowingly performing abortions because of a diagnosis of Down syndrome. So specifically, if that diagnosis is given and the doctor knowingly performs that abortion because of that diagnosis, it would have a punishment for them.
And real quick, one follow-up. You have a supermajority in both chambers. Mm-hmm. Why stop at Down syndrome?
Well, I think that this is an important bill to have a conversation around, and this is my priority this legislative session.
And so so that's something that I'm going to be keeping an eye on as this sort of works its way through the legislative session this year.
Is it the same doctor who performs the abortion who would do the diagnostic test for notifying someone of a Down syndrome fetus?
I don't believe that the Planned Parenthood facility has that ability, but I'm not 100% sure. Again, they're generally the only provider in this state. I think, if memory serves me correct, there has been in the last few years only one that has occurred outside of that. And those are generally performed if, it's after 13 weeks and 6 days, and if the mother's life is at serious risk. And that also is provided in this bill as well. Necessary
exceptions
to save the life of a pregnant woman because her life is endangered by any kind of condition.
Yeah. Well, we'll be paying close attention to that. And then another bill that we heard at the top of the hour in the newscast, main sponsor Fred Deutsch, and this is about birth certificates and blocking the ability for people to change the sex listing on those birth certificates. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
Yeah, so that's a bill that has passed twice in the Idaho State Legislature. I mentioned in that story that the Ninth Circuit Court, covers the state of Idaho, has rejected that bill twice. And so I think, because we're in the Eighth Circuit here, that, the sponsor thinks that it will stand a better chance here. It's going to be heard tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., Central in the House Health and Human Services Committee. One of the questions that I have that I've reached out to the Unified Judicial System is, the sponsor, Republican Fred Deutsch, says that if someone goes to the courts and asks to change the sex listing on their birth certificate, that some judges will say will approve it, and then others will deny it, saying that they don't have the authority on it. And then others, he said, will basically say there's an inconsistency within how judges are applying this, and so he wants to make it consistent and have the legislature say what should happen. But I have reached out to the Unified Judicial System about just how many times this does come up, and what sort of how this is being inconsistently applied. And so I look forward to that information when I get it, and I'll be definitely sure to share that once I have it. And so, yeah, tomorrow at 8 a.m. that bill will be heard.
Which is a quick turnaround time, and the criticism is that by scheduling it so early, there is an effort to block people from coming to testify on this bill, and certainly the transgender community, LGBTQ community, and others are concerned about what this will do to their lives and their rights. Any thoughts on why it got scheduled as quickly as it did, Lee?
That's something I'm definitely keeping an eye on. I don't know what kind of message that really sends about how the chamber is approaching this issue. The House passed something similar last year, but it is a bit different of a makeup. I mean, Republicans did gain a few more seats in the House, but you could argue that, some legislators might view things a little bit differently. And some who got lost in the primaries this year, who might have voted in favor of this, got replaced potentially by people who won't. We don't know. And so it going to House Health and Human Services, I think, is an interesting signal as well. I think some people think that the House State Affairs Committee, which is where Deutsch's bill got heard last year, some people think that the House State Affairs Committee is a little bit more moderate than it was last year. So it going to House Health and Human Services, I think, is interesting, and we'll see how it plays out.
Well, you can follow all our coverage online at sdpb.org/news or sdpb.org/statehouse, and you can listen to gavel-to-gavel coverage of proceedings at sd.net. Also, download the daily SDPB News podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Lee Strubinger and Pierre, thanks so much.
Yeah, good to be here.
Seth Tupper in Rapid, thank you.
You're welcome.
Jackie Hendry, you can see South Dakota Focus on Thursday night. Jackie's in Sioux Falls today. Thanks, Jackie.
Thanks, Lori.